Hello, everybody. This is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business. And I'm here talking today to Virginia Gomez. She's a member of the Committee for the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights at one of the UN mechanisms for human rights. And we are going to be talking about gender, business and human rights. Virginia, we were recently in Delhi together at this fairly path-breaking consultation about applying the gender lens to the business and human rights discourse. Can you tell us your impressions? Where is the state of play? Are you happy with the conversations? What would you like to see more?
Hi, Salil. Good morning. And thank you very much for this opportunity. I found the conversation at the conference really heartbreaking. First of all, I must tell you, I was very happy to see business, gender, and human rights brought together as the title of the conference, because it's a very useful combination. Of course, it's there everywhere, but to see it in a title, I thought was already a sign that the conference would be interesting, which it was. Because first of all, the constituencies were all there. So there was human rights, there was employers, there was trade unions, there was feminists, there were women's rights organizations. There was a little of everything. So I think it was very balanced in terms of approach. And of course, some of the things I heard, we already know, which have been by now recognized, which is the importance or the relevance or the impact of business on the rights of women, on workers' rights. But it is always good to see this discussed at the broader level, which I found happened in the conference. So at the committee, we've tried also to bring these three together. It's an independent expert body, so we do what we can, but we're not here all the time. All of us have other things to do. But what I found interesting is this bringing together. I think the approach was very frank. The trade unions were very explicit about their issues. The women's organizations too. I found it very interesting for my work.
And if you look at one of the interesting things I found was the willingness to engage further with each other as we go along. One of the questions that often comes up when we look at the protect, respect and remedy framework is the idea of remedy. That what is it that the victim of human rights abuses, what recourse does he or she have? In the gender-specific context, in the light of what you heard, what kind of remedies do you see? Because there's of course a state mechanism, but there's a lot of interest now to get companies to develop their own mechanisms. Now, would that erode the state mechanism? How do you see the future there?
No, I don't think it would erode the state mechanism at all, Salil, because the state will always serve its regulatory function, right? That's when it works the best, when the state has a strong regulatory function. Because we often say in our trainings on business and human rights that people do not elect the enterprises. They elected the government, and therefore the government has a regulatory role. And the government has also the role to guarantee equal access to remedies for everyone, irrespective of whether they have the money to pay for it or no. That's why we have free legal aid. So I think the state will never get eroded in its functions. What will happen if the business also accept the remedy framework as being part of their own relationship with victims, I think it could be strengthened mutually, both benefits, because there are some remedies that could really be guaranteed at the level of the company. And that would save immense further going judiciary mechanisms or even non-judiciary mechanisms. And I think the Respect, Protect, Remedy framework has this inbuilt notion that companies are also responsible to address complaints by victims. Mm-hmm. That is a very strong element. Though I think the remedy framework, having said that it's there in the framework, the remedy pillar is the weakest of them all, Salil. Saying at the conference, if you remember, I've kept harping on this issue of access to remedies, because it is the weakest link in that framework.
But do you think that given that the companies are not state entities, clearly don't have the training or expertise to make a system that is fair, just and inclusive. Now, one of the things that comes in the gender context is, of course, that they have to be truly inclusive, listen properly. And, you know, they're not designed to be judicial mechanisms. So what kind of things would you like to see? Would you want greater consultation with NGOs? Would you want arbitration panels? How would you like to strengthen the mechanism of the remedy system?
Well, Salil, I don't think it's ever an either or. Yeah. Choice. It's always a multiple choice. And when you talk of companies, you cannot, you know, put a blanket kind of thing on all companies. There are companies and companies, right? There are big companies that I think by now should be aware of what the real issues in terms of access to justice on gender-related issues is in terms of labor rights. So I would make a difference here between companies that need more training, more awareness raising. They are normally the smaller companies that are faced with financial difficulties and can barely make ends meet. That is one thing. Now, if you look at the multinationals and the big companies, I mean, they have training opportunities for so many issues. Why don't they have training opportunities that are gender sensitive in terms of access to remedies? I don't think really it's a matter of awareness. It might be, but for some, I think it's a matter of will. And I do agree with you that's a matter of understanding of what due diligence is all about. Because companies sometimes think due diligence is just to obey or to comply with the laws that exist. And that's already a big thing. But if we think of weak states, of failed states, of states that face difficulties, I think due diligence goes much further. And you see now many companies using that approach that they indeed, in some countries, they have to fill in for some of the lacks because the state is not in a position to guarantee adequate remedies. Now, in terms of gender, many remedies can also be non-judicial remedies. Like say, I think they need to listen. They need to have personnel who are trained to be gender sensitive. Take an issue of sexual harassment at the workplace. It requires awareness, but it requires a strong push from the state to guarantee that sexual harassment at workplace is criminalized, right? It cannot be only said, all right, we will look into it further. That's why I don't believe only in voluntary codes of conduct. I think they're a step forward, but they're not enough. So I would say some companies, yes, would need arbitration panels, are always welcome, but I would stick here to the strong regulatory role of the state and to a broader and more inclusive understanding of due diligence by companies.
Now, that's excellent. But one of the issues or one of the reasons that companies hesitate sometimes is the whole idea of cultural relativism. And you must be facing it in the context of the committee as well, where the state comes and says, oh, it's different in our country. Oh, it's different in our culture that we respect our women, but we treat them differently. And companies then feel very hesitant because they feel they're intruding in something that's not their domain. What words of advice would you have to such companies?
Well, Salil, you are right. We face this many different states, and it is a difficult issue. I'm not in any way saying that this does not require very careful balancing of all the issues at stake. I agree fully with you. But I also think there is an understanding sometimes that, not sometimes, there has to be an understanding that compliance with labor rights in this case cannot be subject to, in our country, women will feel like this or women will feel like that. Most of the times, when governments say our women will feel, they are not even sure of what their women feel now. We often say this to the state, we cannot make these changes because our societies are not ready. That's a very comfortable argument. But you can't say your societies are not ready because governments need to have a proactive role in changing the mindset. So societies don't change overnight. They don't change in many generations. But to hide behind this false argument that, you know, our societies are not ready for it, in the same way the companies would say, you know, our consumers are not ready for it. Mm. I do think that's the right approach, because that means very much business as usual. The world has moved on and business is not as usual. So I think companies also have a role in changing the mindset. And one of the ways they can do it is to be responsive to the issues of women at the workplace. Right? I'm sure that no woman who feels her complaints have been well dealt with in the workplace will say, well, this is not consistent with my culture. It will be self-defeating, right? So if companies really are gender sensitive, apply all your labor rights compliance with a gender sensitive approach. We just did a recent general comment on fair and just conditions of work, which is Article 7 of the covenant. I worked very hard on it, very much on it. And I tell you, Salil, my first idea was to have a specific section for gender. But then I spoke to many colleagues from trade unions and colleagues of mine who are not really very much into the women's rights issues. But Everyone said to me, well, if you have a separate section on women, it's going to keep, again, the debate like between men and women. And you want to mainstream women's rights into all the normal labor issues. So it was much more difficult to mainstream them. But I think if you take a look at the general comment when you have the time, we were relatively successful in bringing up all the gender-related issues in the labor rights. Well, companies, if they want to have a look at that, they're welcome. I just want to tell you also about the obligations of companies extraterritorially. That is also a major issue now. Because most of the women, where they find exploitative conditions of work, is not in the major companies or in the big subsidiaries. It's in the supply chain. And this ties very much to access to justice, because sometimes these people find their rights violated. To which court, which is the jurisdiction they apply to, they don't know. Because the jurisdiction is so divided, so diluted, that these supply chain workers, unless they really have someone very strong defending them, they don't even know to which jurisdiction to apply. Mm. So here, I think the responsibility of companies is also very much different from what it was a few years ago, given the relevance of the supply chains. So this is another area where I think the big companies need to invest. You know, invest in training, invest in non-judicial mechanisms also at local level, because that is where women really find issues in relation to labor rights violations.
You've set a very good set of task lists for companies. So thank you very much, Virginia, and it's lovely talking to you.
You're welcome, Salil. It was good talking to you too.